The second season of The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills begins tonight on Bravo. For a while, it looked like the show might not make it on. A couple of weeks ago, the estranged husband of one of the housewives committed suicide. Commentator Andrew Wallenstein says that it's an awful situation, but not unprecedented in the world of reality TV.
The Real Housewives franchise has always been equal parts flashy and trashy.
It may look like I have it all, but I want more.
Basically, it's rich women who have nothing better to do and fight with each other to the amusement of their viewers.
In Beverly Hills, it's who you know, and I know everyone.
But the Beverly Hills edition will now have a very different tone, because Bravo had to rejigger the show since the suicide. Russell Armstrong was going to appear this season along with his wife, Taylor, one of the stars of the show. But now, he's been edited out. Now, this actually isn't the first time reality TV has had to contend with something a little too real. MTV found itself in a similar situation back in 2009 with Gone Too Far, a reality series featuring DJ AM ministering to drug addicts trying to kick the habit.
I'm on the way to Olivia's house, and the whole family's going to be there. And it's intervention time. Gina told me she wants help. I got a ticket. I got a treatment facility ready to accept her. Here comes the do or die part. I'm afraid she's all talk.
Just a few months before the show was to air, DJ AM died of an accidental overdose. But MTV was still able to put the show on the air with the family's blessing. No doubt Bravo is proceeding with Taylor's approval. Having a grieving widow complain? That's about as bad as publicity gets. Sometimes networks in this kind of predicament find it's better just to cancel than go forward.
Uno, dos, tres, cuatro!
I love it. I love money. I'm gonna love my time in Mexico.
VH1 shelved reality series I Love Money 3 when one of the contestants ended up murdering his own wife. But cancellation didn't happen with The Real Housewives, because such a move would have been tantamount to the network accepting responsibility for the suicide, which it shouldn't have to. Armstrong was clearly dealing with personal and financial troubles that the show didn't help, but didn't cause either. Given all these reality TV tragedies, you'd think the industry is doing some soul-searching right about now. But it's likely this suicide will be forgotten soon enough. That is, until the next time something like this happens.
Andrew Wallenstein is an editor at Variety. Author Mark Kaufman thinks all people, no matter their language or culture, share at least one common denominator, the search for self. And today, for our series You Must Read This, he recommends a book about one man's journey to find himself.
Being a seeker these days isn't easy. Our world wants us to be certain, whatever our views, and beyond that, to be consumers. Then, too, the notion of seeking got something of a bad name back in the 60s and 70s. When it became so entwined with drugs and pretend or misguided teachers. Yet at the beginning of my seventh decade, I find myself pulled back to the power of the quest, feeling an urgency about confronting those big questions so easy to shelve earlier in my life. For some guideposts, I returned to a book that both inspired and troubled me years ago, Peter Matheson's The Snow Leopard, a tale of seeking in the extreme. The book recounts the author's trek into the wilds of the Dolpo region of Nepal in the company of another great naturalist and adventurer, George Schaller. The two are ostensibly making the journey to learn about a rare Himalayan sheep. And if they are unusually fortunate, they might catch a glimpse of the most elusive animal this side of the Yeti, the snow leopard. As becomes immediately apparent, the author is an especially keen observer of the natural world and, most compellingly, of himself. The rugged Matheson describes matter-of-factly the endless difficulties they face. Weeks of unexpected monsoon rain, the frequent disappearances of essential porters, but the hardships of the trek are a stand-in for the real drama. Matheson has just lost his wife to cancer. His hurt and confusion are so great that he places his 8-year-old son into the care of others so he can set off for Dalpo. Why he did that, how he could be so appealing yet so irresponsible was always a puzzle to me. Clearly, Matheson was a seeker, a driven man who had consumed his share of drugs, who later turned to Zen Buddhism. But more apparent to me now is that tracking the snow leopard was a search for something essential at a time of crisis. Selfish? No doubt. But so honest and ultimately revelatory that forgiveness comes easily to this reader, especially now that hard self-examination is so devalued. For $5,000, after all, you can take a guided trek today that follows the author's path to Crystal Mountain. His physical path, that is. I've spent the last 3 years of my career in the company of a different breed of seekers, men and women on what may well be the scientific quest of the century. They're hunting for life beyond Earth and are learning extraordinary things about our planet and the cosmos as they search. They, like Matheson, may never encounter their snow leopards. But that's hardly the point. It's the looking at life and looking for life that's important, and Matheson lays out plainly but elegantly why that is and why it always must be.
Mark Kaufman is a science writer at The Washington Post and author of the book First Contact: Scientific Breakthroughs in the Hunt for Life Beyond Earth. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. It's Labor Day, and we begin this hour on the road back to work. Last January, we gave digital recorders to 6 people, all living in St. Louis, and asked them to keep an audio diary. Like some 14 million Americans, the people in our series started the year unemployed and on the job hunt. 8 months later, all now have work. But for several, the struggles continue. NPR's Tamara Keith takes us back to St. Louis for an update.
Randy Howland was the first one to return to work.
I've got an entry-level customer service position working 3 to midnight, just a little bit above minimum wage. It's certainly nowhere near where I want to be and need to be. But I am fully employed, so there's a good thing there.
I asked each of the 6 to answer the same question.
Am I fully employed?
This is Brian Barfield.
Yes, but I'm right now seasonal, which means that I go in at half rate, and I work the same hours, do the same job as everyone else for half the money. And if I prove myself, then I get hired as a permanent employee.
And his wife, Jennifer Barfield.
Am I fully employed? Yes, but I'm a contractor. So I am working full-time hours, but things are very iffy because contract jobs' nature is, you know, get rid of them easily.
Hi, this is Annika Trotter. It's August 13th. I am now fully employed as a contractor with an aerospace company. I work full-time. This is a permanent position. This is for real.
Ray Meyer started working for a temp agency in March.
Am I fully employed? No, I'm still doing contract work. They have me going to a job right now, and the job, I'm told, is going to last now until the end of October, but I think we're going to be done much sooner.
And finally, Cassandra Bronner, who got a permanent position in July.
I work for an event planner, and I'm like a marketing coordinator, PR coordinator, and slash everything else. It's about half of what I was making before, but it's more than what I'd been making when I was unemployed, so we're fine.
That's 3 people in temporary positions. The other 3 are in permanent jobs, but only 2 of them are happy. 1 person is making more than she used to. The rest are earning much less. Cassandra Bronner is a single mother with 2 daughters. She worked at Anheuser-Busch and went from an entry-level position to become a marketing manager with the company. She was laid off in March 2010 as the company downsized after a merger. And the first thing she wanted to do was be with her girls.
I think I was told probably around 10 o'clock in the morning After I left the company, I called my mother to tell her that she didn't have to pick the girls up. When it was time for them to get out of school, I was there, and they were like, what's going on? Why are you here? But they were excited. And I just told them that mommy has to find another job. I'm going to get a new job or something. I don't work at that job anymore.
For a long time, Bronner tried to get her old life back. She applied almost exclusively to large companies because she saw herself as a large company person. She was looking for a job just like the one she lost. But slowly that changed.
This is Cassandra. It's February 5th, 2011. And I was talking to my mother, and she said, you know, I was thinking that you should look into starting your own business making cupcakes. And I said, what? That just sounds a little bit too much for me. I've never had any desires to open my own business or work for myself.
But she kept thinking about it.
I started getting excited about it, and I haven't been excited about anything in a really long time, a really, really long time.
Cassandra Bronner started to see herself differently.
Today is Monday, March 21st, 2011. Today I have an interview. It's a marketing assistant for an event planning company called Events Above the Rest.
Events Above the Rest is a tiny company that plans parties and weddings, the kind of place that hadn't even been on Bronner's radar for most of her year-long search.
I just received a call from Miss Ellis at Events Above the Rest, and she informed me that I have the job.
Bronner is taking a real pay cut, and she doesn't get health insurance. But there are upsides, too. She goes to work at a place where she feels like she's an important part of the team.
Good morning.
Hey.
How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good.
Her boss is sending baking business her way with some of the events, and she's out of the 8-to-5 rat race, which means she can walk her girls to the bus in the morning.
Here comes the bus. Give me a kiss. Have a great day.
Bye, Mom.
You make more money in the corporate setting, and there's more, I guess, perks on paper, as you'd say, but your quality of life, I think, my quality of life, I can't speak for everybody, my quality of life is much better.
It's March 31st. This is Randy.
For Randy Howland, the road back to work didn't lead to a better place.
Our mortgage was due today, and my wife's mother came up with a couple $100 to help us meet that. We've got a job, but it's not enough at this point.
There was a time when Randy and his wife Lisa would buy things for her mom. That was back when Randy earned six figures. They had season tickets to St. Louis Rams football games and went to 30 Cardinals games a year. That was back when they didn't have to borrow money from Lisa's mom.
Asking her for money kills me. It kills Randy, too. But, well, thank God we have somebody that can help us.
The Howlands had hoped that Randy's new job, combined with Lisa's work from home as a hairdresser, would be enough to cover their bills.
It's Memorial Day. We borrowed another $300 from my mother-in-law. My wife's hair salon business is not doing very well, but she could really use some new clients. I mean, really use some new clients.
Shortly after this was recorded, Lisa decided she would try to get a second job. The store where she buys beauty supplies is hiring.
It's Monday the 18th, and a little mixed feelings today as I make my wife a bit of breakfast. Because my wife is starting a job, I'm happy for her, but at the same time, I should be the one that's got the good job. There you go. Congrats on your first day, hon.
Lisa is uneasy.
Are you nervous?
I'm very nervous today. I wasn't when I got up, but I am now. The last time I worked for somebody else was when I met you, which was... about 24 years ago. Get today under my belt, and I'm sure tomorrow will be better.
2 weeks later, Randy Howland is still stewing. He feels guilty that Lisa has to work.
I work from 3 to 12, and my wife works during the day, so we don't see each other. But that's no big deal. She's helping make ends meet. And at least this month, we don't have to borrow from any relatives or friends to do that. Excuse me while I drink my coffee.
And Randy continues to search for something better, a job that will pay more than $10 an hour, a job that will allow him to be the breadwinner again. Ray Meyer is still searching for something better, too. He was laid off from his job as a regional bank manager almost 3 years ago now, and he finally gave in and started working with a temp agency. On the road back to work, a new job isn't the final destination. It's just a stopping point along the way.
Well, good morning. This is Ray. I'm on break from the temporary job that I have. I'm outside. It's good to be out and about, and it's certainly good to be in the morning traffic with everybody else.
Meyer is sitting in his purple Dodge Caravan. There's a rust spot on the door, and it needs repairs more often than it used to. When Meyer bought it 14 years ago, he never imagined he'd still have it today. But he also never imagined he'd be working for a temp agency making $15 an hour.
I think it's difficult for me working for a place. And I didn't say working with a place, but working for a place, because I just am finding that these temporary jobs that I'm working on tend to treat their temporary employees differently. And I guess because we're disposable.
Meyer is still searching for a job in banking. He knows he won't make what he did before, likely wouldn't even be in management, but it would still be so much better than this temp work.
It's Monday, and I haven't recorded anything for a while. My job just dismissed out last Thursday night, but the job didn't tell me until I got home. Then Manpower, the people I'm working through, called me and let me know that I didn't need to go back.
Meyer is disappointed, but there's something more. The uncertainty of temp work is gnawing away at him. It's like every few months he relives his layoff.
I guess I'm a little gun-shy. I'm afraid everything I do is going to end up with me losing my job. You know, where I'm at right now, you know, if you make the boss mad, you take all of your stuff home at the end of the day because you don't know if your key's going to work to get back in the door the next day. And I think we all feel that way. You never know for sure if you're going to have a job from one day to the next.
He'd never say it this way, but you can tell Meyer is still traumatized by the loss of his banking job back in 2008. He was working on a teller machine when his boss called him into the office. He had no idea what was coming.
I don't know that I'll ever feel safe again. Before, I felt like I was doing a good job, and they pulled the rug right out from under me, and I just didn't see it coming.
Meyer's current temp gig is supposed to last through October, but he isn't counting on it going past September. The temp agency has been good about getting him into new work quickly, but it isn't like having a permanent job. There are no sick days, no security, no health insurance or retirement benefits. Months after returning to work, such as it is, all six of the people on the road back to work are still digging out of financial and emotional holes. Some are still behind on their mortgages. Most need to catch up on other bills. Savings depleted. And their wish lists are long. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
You can learn more about the people we're following on the road back to work at our website. And you'll also find all of the stories in our series so far, photos and additional excerpts from their audio diaries. That's at npr.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. Today in Your Health, we have two reports on chronic fatigue syndrome. We'll hear about possible treatments in a moment. First, we'll ask some questions about the cause. Researchers still are not sure why people suffer pain, exhaustion, anxiety, insomnia, and other symptoms sometimes for years. They have suspected viruses, but have not proven which one. Joanne Silberner reports on what that uncertainty means for people living with the disease.
Clinical psychologist Katrina Byrne of Seattle used to run, play racquetball, see patients, and teach courses. That was before she developed chronic fatigue syndrome.
There are days when I'm bedfast and I get up only to use the bathroom or get something to eat or drink. There are days when I'm housebound, and that's the most typical day for me right now.
For the past 27 years, she's been prone to severe crashes where she's sensitive to light and noise and unable to read or watch TV.
Ill, like the way you feel when you have the flu, an unrelenting, unremitting flu.
The first doctors Byrne went to weren't much help.
One doctor told me it was related to anxiety. Another one said it was dehydration. A third one said it was hormonal. A fourth one said it was stress-related and I needed to exercise.
The problem back then was that no one much knew what was going on. With no known cause, there was no definitive lab test. There still isn't. And Anthony Komaroff, a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School, says that troubled doctors.
I would say most doctors were very, very skeptical. First, this illness is defined predominantly by a group of symptoms. And so doctors were asking, what's the evidence, objective evidence, that there's something physically wrong with these people?
Over the years, researchers have identified various brain, immune system, and energy metabolism irregularities. Komaroff points to a study done a couple of years ago by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. It showed that the majority of doctors now recognize chronic fatigue syndrome as an illness. Today, an estimated 1 million Americans are thought to have it. But lots of regular folks are still doubters, at least in the experience of Cynthia Johnson of Lake Oswego, Oregon. She says the disbelief makes the disease worse. Johnson is a breast cancer survivor, but in October 2009, she was hit with a bad flu that hasn't gone away.
People really admire you for fighting cancer, and they're very excited that you've survived. They congratulate you for surviving. Nobody does that day to day for CFS. They are just like, oh.
Just as she was diagnosed a couple of years ago, a report came out in a scientific journal linking a virus called XMRV to chronic fatigue syndrome. But 14 months later, four scientific papers claimed the virus was just a lab contaminant. Few in the field are hopeful that the cause has been discovered. The federal government is sponsoring two large studies that should answer the question once and for all. For Katrina Byrne in Seattle and Cynthia Johnson in Portland, the initial report, even if it turns out to be a blind alley, did some good. Cynthia Johnson.
I was happy to see all the attention in the press to XMRV, simply to bring attention to the disease. So my first thought was at least people are writing about it.
Johnson has been given a 50-50 chance by her doctor of throwing off the symptoms in a couple of years. She knows what she'll do if an effective treatment comes along.
I like to make plans, you know, plan for the future, plan for tomorrow, and know that it would go well to make an appointment for the doctors or a haircut or to meet friends and be confident that I would feel reasonably well. You know, walk as far as I could and go to the beach.
Some changes are coming soon. The results of those two studies on whether there's an XMRV connection may be released at a meeting in Canada at the end of the month. Meanwhile, advocates for people with chronic fatigue syndrome are pushing for a name change to make the syndrome sound like more than a description of someone who just needs a nap. For NPR News, I'm Joanne Silberner.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Jackie Leiden. Michelle Martin is away. Happy Labor Day. Coming up, we'll talk about how we're all working so much that there's too little downtime to enjoy a family outing or even a good book. With all of the ways technology allows people to reach us, work-life balance is more and more an imbalance. That's in a few minutes. But first, it is Labor Day, a day in which we take a moment to think about the millions of Americans in the labor force. Only about 12% belong to a union today versus 20% a generation ago in 1983. And amid all of the economic uncertainty, unions have agreed to contracts loaded with concessions just to keep those they represent employed. This is a criticism lobbed at the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, better known as the Teamsters Union, and one member is so fed up that she's vying to lead the group. Joining us now is Sandy Pope, the first woman to run for the presidency of the Teamsters. The election is in October. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for inviting me.
You started out as a tractor trailer driver, and you've worked your way up to being president of a Teamsters local in New York. Why do you want to run the entire entity of over a million workers?
I want to because we need new leadership in this union, and a group of us thought that I would be the best person to run. I have the most name recognition, and I'm willing to do it. It's a pretty tough job to run for office in this union.
Especially when the membership has been declining.
Yes, but it's also why people want change so much in our union.
Let's talk a little bit about your background. You were studying in college to become a lawyer. You quit college. Tell us about your work and about becoming a driver. I understand your CB moniker was Troublemaker.
Yes. I got involved in a strike the first job I ever had out of college, and I saw firsthand how unions could really empower people, and actually it was the one thing that helped those workers get more than minimum wage and better working conditions. My whole life was transformed by that strike, and I decided to work with other people who were trying to transform the Teamsters Union from the corrupt organization that it was at that time into a democratic union that would fight for its members.
So you belong to the Teamsters since 1978?
Yes.
And now you're crisscrossing the country, I understand, in your red Ford Focus, trying to drum up grassroots support. You are running against the current general president, James Hoffa Jr., and he has been in office since 1998, a pretty formidable candidate.
Yes, he is. He's very well known, and his father certainly was very notorious, but also a well-respected leader by the members of this union. Many members thought that his son would follow in his father's footsteps, but are quite disappointed now.
I'd like to read a criticism of your campaign that comes from one of Mr. Hoffa's slate in the election. He said, "Sandy Pope can wish upon a prayer of a rainbow. She's very critical, but she doesn't offer any solutions. She doesn't have a rationale to justify her campaign. She's a vanity candidate." What do you say to that?
That's ridiculous. I went around with volunteers for 2 months, and we collected 50,000 signatures in zero-degree weather from all sorts of members all over this country. So I would say that I'm far from being a vanity candidate. And whoever made that quote also hasn't read my literature or gone on my website, I guess, because I do have a lot of ideas for how to change things around. They are getting back to basics, and that means getting the members involved, communicating between locals, working together, building solidarity within our union.
What are you hearing from people out there when you campaign?
I get messages every day from people saying, please help us, from North Carolina, from Kansas City, from Los Angeles. And they're losing pay, they're losing jobs, they're losing their pensions, and they don't see the international union fighting for them like they think they should.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More. I'm Jackie Leiden, and I'm speaking with Sandy Pope, who's running for president of the Teamsters Union, and she's president of her own local in New York. The election is coming up in October. Sandy, unions have been declining. The Teamsters lost 700,000 members since their peak in the 1970s, and as we've been saying, have made concessions, not just on wages, but also pensions. Health insurance has been an issue, and of course, there's the general economic downturn to deal with. What are a labor union's, what is your union, the Teamsters Union's, biggest resource right now for staying mobilized in these very tough times?
Communication with the members, organizing them. We have many locals that are operating by themselves and being left to fend for themselves against large corporations, whether it's Coca-Cola, United Parcel Service. And if we unite together and get our members more engaged on the issues, then we'll do a lot better. We'll be a lot stronger.
You mentioned United Parcel Service. That is the biggest single employer of people in the Teamsters Union, right?
Yes.
And you'd like to see a more aggressive campaign there?
Oh, absolutely. The members there are hurting badly. They're being pushed into inhumane production production activity, the drivers that go out and deliver packages used to have to deliver maybe 120 stops a day. They were still this is a very efficient company, a very profitable company, and now they're expected to deliver 190 stops a day. This is just in 10 years' time, and some of it is because of technology, but there's only so fast you can drive and only so fast the human body can move. People are hurting their bodies. They're working ridiculous hours, and they're getting home so late they don't see their families, and that kind of thing is going on throughout corporate America where these productivity pushes are going on, use of technology to monitor people and to push people even more. And rather than hire people, by the way, there's a lot of talk of jobs and how you create jobs. Well, a lot of these companies are eliminating full-time jobs by pushing the people that they have to ridiculous numbers of hours and speed.
I'd like to ask you about being a woman in this campaign. And looking at a picture of you from New York Magazine, you're with about six brawny guys. It says you sometimes hold meetings at Desmond's Tavern in Manhattan. Some people might think of the Teamsters as very much a predominantly male domain. It is predominantly male. But are women getting more involved? You say that you were one of the first women you ever saw at even your local meetings back in the day, in 1978.
Women are getting much more involved in the union. We probably have 25% of the membership are women. There are more women in the leadership as well, but we haven't pushed into the leadership of locals very well. And Jim Hoffa only has one woman on his entire executive board slate out of, I think it's 26 members. And so I think that's a very sad statement.
And we'll just mention that only 16 of 407 locals across North America are led by women. I'd just like to ask, what was it like to be a tractor-trailer driver for you, your CB moniker, Troublemaker?
It was scary at first, learning to drive, and there were men that didn't like me driving a truck or would make fun of me, but there were plenty of other men that really reached out and were helpful and showed me the ropes. It was difficult loading the trucks and doing the physical labor involved, and I just had to get a little bit stronger. But I really worked hard to become a part of the union and show the guys that I wasn't just somebody there to look for help from somebody else, that I was going to be a good worker, a good driver, but also a good union member.
Why should unions be the ones to protect worker Sandy Pope instead of just having general regulations in place?
I think unions are the best because the members themselves can dictate how they want to bargain with a particular employer. And it's a group activity that's, I think, is more wholesome way to do things than, you know, I talk to many friends of mine and other workers who are in non-union environments. And it's a dog-eat-dog situation. You don't know who's going to stab you in the back, or older workers get fired all the time and replaced with younger workers. That sort of thing doesn't happen when there's a union.
Are you worried that unions are a thing of the past, a hindrance on business, a jobs crusher?
No, not at all. I think that unions created the middle class in this country, and that they provide respect on the job, and all sorts of regulations that are in place are because unions pushed for it. So public education, 8-hour day, overtime, all those things came because unions pushed for those things, not because some elected official thought it was a good idea. And if we relieve that pressure, if we don't have that pressure, we're going to go backwards. And we are seeing it go backwards. Look at the attack on public workers right now. So the unions must turn things around and get stronger. And there's no shortage of people who want to join unions. It's just very difficult to do in this environment right now.
We are thinking about Labor Day. What's resonating most in your campaign? The excitement of being the first woman, or knowing what it's like to have the same jobs that a lot of the people you want to represent have?
It is exciting to be a woman in this campaign, but frankly, it's not the first thing I think about at all. What's exciting to me is, and gratifying, is that it's building a momentum. 50,000 people signed petitions for me to run a year ago, and I was very proud that we were able to get that kind of support, and it's just growing and growing, and I'm glad that I've been able to give people hope that we can turn this union around. We're getting bigger and bigger groups of people gathering as I travel around the country. And I have hundreds of friends on Facebook and people contacting me every day by email, very happy that there's a new course being pushed in this union that is going to respect the members, listen to them, help them get stronger and better leadership at the local level as well. I really look forward to being able to unify this union, but also to reach out to non-union people out there. We should be defending everyone, all workers in this country, not just our union members.
Sandy Pope is a member of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, the Teamsters, and she's vying to become the first woman to run for president of the Teamsters Union, and she joined us from our New York bureau. Thank you very much, Sandy Pope.
Thank you.